The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. And joining us in the studio today for Campus Voices, we have Professor Tammy Anderson from the University's Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice. And Tammy, you've done a lot of research in not just the drug problem, but in the different drug problems that we face nationally and here in the Wilmington area.
That's true. Dating way back, many years back, to my doctoral dissertation in the 1990s. So it's been, well, actually before then, crack cocaine, powder cocaine, and those epidemics of the 80s. And then from there, heroin, another heroin, HIV risk, policy reform with welfare reform, Clinton's welfare reform, which had an impact on Social Security disability benefits for all kinds of drug users. The focus then shifted to women drug dealers, to people exiting prison with drug problems. Then I launched my big rave study of the rave scene as a cultural phenomenon, plus all the drug use that's associated with that. And today I'm working on the prescription drug abuse problem and heroin epidemic.
There's just so many different ways that drug use has affected the United States and its people.
And persistent over the course of many centuries. So it's a problem that ebbs and flows and mutates into another drug at a different point in time, different set of circumstances, but there are lots of similarities that we can trace.
You said over centuries?
Over centuries. That's true.
I didn't realize that because I thought that the drug problem was, you know, starting in the 1940s, 1950s?
Oh, no. The United States of America first got involved in drug policy, sort of drug interventions in the late 1800s, and then moving on through all of the 20th century. In fact, most of today's drug laws, the drug laws we have today, are a culmination of revisions and enhancements to many of those that were started over 100 years ago.
What were some of the earliest regulations back in the 19th century? Because, I mean, you know, I grew up dealing with folk music, people singing songs that have cocaine still in the Coca-Cola. You can still get cocaine at the drugstore.
Right. And it's interesting you should use the 60s and 70s as a point of reference, because that's actually the point of reference people today are using to discuss the current heroin and prescription drug, the opiate epidemic we're having. But in fact, the first opiate epidemic was at the turn of the 20th century and resulted in our first major piece of legislation, which was the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1916. So that was the first big federal law, and it regulated, I'm sorry, it's 1914. It regulated heroin, opiates, and cocaine.
Now that you're talking about drug use going back in the 19th century, I immediately think of a cultural reference, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, that movie with Warren Beatty. And who is it, Julie Christie? And she ends up in an opium den, and he ends up dying in the snow while she's smoking in, you know, an opium den out in the West in about the 1880s.
And that image portrayed in fiction is a familiar trope that anti-drug crusaders, policymakers, have used successfully over the course of time. There is a white female victim of a drug menace. There usually is definitely a male, a villain, and often that villain is of ethnic or racial minority, a foreign-born or of a minority population perceived as a real threat, who is using drugs to intoxicate and therefore take advantage of the innocent middle-class white female.
Wow. You're getting into not just actual problems, but sort of the marketing of the problem, almost.
Yes, that's something we're actually talking a lot about in class right now, in both of my classes, social deviance and alcohol, drugs, and crime here, is the social construction of drug scares, which is, of course, related to but yet separate from their real impact and the real problems. But those anti-drug crusades do shape how our country will respond to real problems.
And then we emailed ahead of the show. I mentioned to you a couple of historical references that go back to the 70s and the 80s. But Carlos Leder, one of Pablo Escobar's lieutenants, referred to cocaine as the atomic bomb of Latin America, almost like he was taking revenge on the American people. And you think of that whole Iran-Contra scandal. Some people were viewing that as the government's fine with the Nicaraguans sending cocaine into the black parts of Los Angeles.
It's very difficult to go back over the course of drug policy, drug epidemics, and to describe them without some sort of racial minority, ethnic minority threat, inequality. It's a persistent and annoying feature of our country's legacy with drug problems. We can't seem to move past racial and ethnic inequality. And the construction of good guys and bad guys is done for political, economic reasons, et cetera. And I could sit here and talk trace how that plays out and impacts racial and ethnic minorities over every single drug epidemic and law we have. I'm sure we don't have time to do all that. But it is something that sociologists and social scientists in general have paid attention to because we're concerned with inequality.
Well, fast forwarding to now, what you see is a large underclass of blacks, mostly males, in jail. And it's exacerbating issues that are already out there in the community.
Yes, that's true. The impact of later 20th century war on drugs, harsh sentencing has decimated inner city black communities and has taken, as you say, captive many black males who are not able to contribute to society, not able to father their children, who are not able to become successful in their own right, vote, exercise their democratic rights. Now, the good news is President Obama seems to be inching his way toward a reform era. And he wants to take us off of a war footing when it comes to drug problems. We've been on a war footing with handling drug problems since the Kennedy administration and even before Kennedy, which was a short-term presidency. We were on a war footing with Roosevelt, et cetera, and in the early part of the 20th century. So this is an opportune time, and we're starting to see some of those draconian punitive laws fall away. The sentencing gap that put so many black males in prison between crack and powder cocaine has been shortened. And some people have been granted early release from prison because of that. Let's hope we don't make some of those same mistakes, though, with the heroin, fentanyl, and opiate prescription drug epidemics, though.
What mistakes are you afraid we'll make again?
Well, the mistakes I'm afraid we'll make again are responding in the punitive ways that we're familiar with and using the same sort of scapegoats that we've used in the past. I've been trying to track media stories in addition to my own research. And certainly the victims of opiate overdoses and heroin overdoses are today being constructed as suffering from a medical problem, which is good news. They need medical treatment. They don't need to be sent to prison. I agree with that, and I think a lot of people will. They are predominantly white people. This is a very white epidemic.
So what you're saying is if it's a white epidemic, we'll get you medical treatment. If it's a black epidemic, we'll throw you in the slammer.
Well, it sort of looks that way in the respect that we're talking right now. And our job is to investigate all the different reasons that it could possibly look that way. But yes, it does look that way on its face right now. I just want to call attention. There's, of course, historical factors that play a role. I mean, crack cocaine happened when we had conservatives in office, You know, and they legislated policy right after the drug liberal era of the 60s and 70s. And they're like, let's turn it around. Let's get strict. They went right after inner city, impoverished, predominantly black community that was hit hard by crack. And lo and behold, we saw 25 years what that policy, those policies did to us, and we're shifting course. Is it a historical coincidence, or does race have something to do with it? Is it both? Is it other things? Very good question.
I would imagine it's race and economic despair that lead people to that as a form of escape.
Yes and no. And I think this gets back to something you mentioned earlier, that there isn't one explanation that fits all groups.
Right.
The current heroin and prescription drug epidemics are largely white and they're disproportionately middle class, although working class and poor whites are affected too. So the sense that addiction hits one social class and not others is not true. However, how we respond to it definitely historically shows there are some patterns in how we will respond based on who's hit.
Abby has something she'd like to ask you.
I was just wondering if you could expand a little bit more on the opiate and heroin epidemic that's going on, because more and more I'm hearing of acquaintances and my peers who are getting mixed up in heroin, whereas a few years ago that would have been like unfathomable. I feel like there's been this shift where heroin used to be like one of the harder drugs that people generally don't gravitate towards, and now it's creeping into being accepted in people in my age group, and I was just wondering why there's been that dramatic shift.
Right. Well, you're very perceptive about some of the characteristics of today's heroin epidemic, that it rings true. So today's heroin epidemic is predominantly young people, people under 30. The profile that we're seeing, according to the CDC and news reports, is middle-class backgrounds. They're disproportionately white. In fact, I don't want to say it's exclusively a white problem, but there's extreme underrepresentation at this point of other race and ethnic groups. It's very, very white, middle class, and young. That's the heroin epidemic and overdose problem. It's connected to the prescribed opiate problem that our medical industry has unfortunately helped create through prescribing pain medications, all of which are opiate-based, for pain management and other types of disease. Young people of your age group and younger get their hands on their folks' prescribed opiates, and they have pill parties, and they learn about the pleasurable euphoric effects of painkillers there. That group then transitions to heroin because heroin is cheaper, easier to get, and purer. But today, also, what's contributing to the heroin problem is it's being cut with fentanyl by drug dealers, which is a prescribed medication that's getting into the wrong hands. I don't recall a time in history where we've had an overlap between legal drugs and illegal markets. This is going to challenge us in some new ways, but a lot of it is also familiar. The first heroin epidemic we ever had as a nation was at the turn of the 20th century, which led to the Harrison Narcotics Act. It was not the Vietnam War veteran heroin epidemic from Southeast Asia in the 60s and 70s. That was not the first heroin epidemic. In some respects, today's epidemic looks like that of the early 20th century, middle class, connected to medicine, the practice of medicine with opiates. So it's very, very challenging. And we have different populations today addicted and overdosing on opiates for different reasons. Most opiate overdoses today are to prescribed painkillers. They're not to heroin overdoses. And we now have more opiate overdoses than we have fatalities from motor vehicle accidents.
Wow.
No, it's the first time. It's a very important and devastating development in history. CDC has just announced that this year.
Well, I'm a little older than the two of you. I mean, when I was in college in the early 70s and high school in the, you know, late 60s, nobody I knew did heroin. I mean, that was something nobody touched.
That's right, because it was, the image of heroin use was dirty, and also the street sense of how pure or good the quality of the heroin was not very reputable. It was not very attractive. And in the past, because of that, you used to have to inject heroin. Today, the heroin is so pure, you can snort it. And the route of administration really acts as a barrier to people's willingness to try it. If you can snort a drug, it's very different. Now, eventually, you start snorting it, you're going to have to inject it because you'll build tolerance to it. So they'll inject anyway. But that, scholars have also shown, is one of the reasons there's less of an obstacle to heroin use today. It's pure. The image has changed, and it's easier to administer.
This is, as we said at the beginning of this conversation, just one of the drug issues that we're facing. Another one that I'm curious what your reaction to is, as marijuana becomes decriminalized or legalized for medical use or legalized for recreational use, I mean, how do you think that's going to change the landscape overall in terms of policy and what else might happen?
Well, the way marijuana legislation is coming about is through a healthcare sort of medicalized narrative. We're not a nation that woke up one day and warmed up to the idea that we should legalize this drug because we all want to get high. that really didn't happen. We tolerate that line of thinking when it comes to alcohol, you know, that it's sort of our right to let off some steam, have a drink, relax, and it's okay to sort of drink in excess once in a while. But we're not ready to get there with some of these other substances. So we got to medical marijuana through our concerns and the effective campaigning that there were people who needed marijuana for medical reasons. So marijuana now is being transitioned from an illegal drug into a legitimate medicine to treat some conditions. It's debatable. I mean, I think you could argue that there are other intentions as well. I just did an interview for the Christian Science Monitor about why men favor legalization of marijuana more so than women. And the fact of the matter is that men smoke marijuana more. I argued they smoke marijuana more than do women, and they therefore don't want to get in trouble for something that they're doing more frequently than are women. So are there some underneath some motivations to let me get high without, you know, suffering the long arm of the law? Maybe. But the country is now moving into a medical framework with defining addiction as a disease of the brain and responding to it from a healthcare footing rather than a war footing. And the president, it's not a surprise when you look at how the president is continuing to move us in a healthcare. This is a man whose legacy, one of his legacies is going to be healthcare reform.
Yeah.
Right. And so it does make sense, although the feds have not done anything at the federal level yet. It's all state level initiatives. The other thing that could be driving it is economics and looking for tax revenues. Colorado boasted $150 million in tax revenues this past year. That's a windfall for states where their budgets are strapped. They look for ways to raise tax revenues without increasing property and income tax.
Is it going to tie into the use of other drugs that people are using? I mean, when I was young, it's like, oh my God, marijuana is a gateway drug to heroin, you know.
That argument just never goes away. That has been around. It doesn't. It's been around, you know, all of the 20th century. It stays with us today. Again, we just discussed this in class. You know, there's science on both sides of it. And if you go to the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Law page, you'll get some science that, you know, supports one point of view. If you go to some scholars, you'll get agreement. And there are other studies that show marijuana does act as a gateway drug. So it'll be interesting to see how, you know, people, what side people come down on that. I don't really have a firm position on it. I do know this. If you ask a heroin user if they've started drug using with heroin, most of them will tell you no. You know, they have an experience with other substances. But if you ask the other question to the majority of Americans who have used marijuana, whether they progress to any other harder substance, the answer to that is also no.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, you know, how we can reconcile really support for the gateway or the so-called stepping stone theories, but it remains in our narrative.
You know, I wonder if the stepping stone narrative, as you call it, I like that better than gateway, has more to do with I'm doing something that's against the law. And so.
So this is an excellent, excellent point. And some people, academics, argue that we'll see the novelty of these marijuana decriminalization, medicalization, legalization laws wear off in a short period of time and will return to stability. Right now, in some states where there's new reformed marijuana laws, marijuana use rates are up. And so it's not really surprising people will argue that in the short term, rates of use would increase. But they argue they will also stabilize, whether that's because the novelty will wear off or the unspoken reality of marijuana reform. It may be that you can't be sent to prison for marijuana, but you could be drug tested at work and fired. It doesn't mean that once your state changes its marijuana laws that you are immune to other sorts of controls. And that's something people really need to get educated about, is that, you know, you're not being given a free pass to smoke marijuana and be high at liberty right now. You've basically got a criminal justice reform, but it doesn't mean you won't suffer the consequences in some other aspect of life. The police are going to be testing for drug driving in addition to drunk driving. Those technologies will develop.
As you were talking, for some reason, I showed my disassociating brain, I guess, but I was thinking about how the British Navy, for the longest time, tried to control its sailors by giving them a certain amount of rum just the right amount to keep them under control, but not so much that get drunk and fall from the masts. I just don't know. Am I being too cynical to think that if we are making progress towards treating a lot of drug issues as medical issues, are there some drug uses that are being ignored by policy to try and control certain segments of the population? Or am I taking us down a rabbit hole that we'd better not go down?
Well, no, I don't think you're taking it. I think it's a fair question. So, you know, when I wrote the Rave book, and I published that in 2009, one of the factors I argued and found contributed to the decline of the rave scene was the 2003 Rave Act, which is technically called Illicit Drug Anti-Proliferation Act. And now raves are commercialized and they're popular, but still people, young people, college student age, are dying, and younger, 15-year-olds, 13-year-olds, et cetera. So there's been a call, and I'm involved in consulting with the legislative reform movement to roll back the Rave Act, which holds rave promoters responsible for the drug use that happens on their premises. And what the law does is it disallows them to take the precautions they need to protect the health of their ravers, because it reads any such protection as acknowledgement that you know drug use is happening at your event and you are accommodating it. So that if I put a medical tent with healthcare workers, or I put water stations throughout the venue, those are all things that could help people who run into complications with ecstasy, Molly, etc. The law is written as such that those things could also be read that the promoter knows drug use is happening at the event and is accommodating it, and therefore can be held criminally responsible. We are not making progress on reforming the Rave Act right now. The feds don't have it as much on their radar screen as they do this heroin epidemic, opiate epidemic, then fentanyl problem. They're overwhelmed. There are many things a president has to deal with. And so back to your question, there is a sense that we work one drug at a time. And this is sort of like an archaic law, is how I see it, from the Bush administration, that should probably be revisited in light of some of the health emergencies that we continue to have.
That just makes no sense. If you have first aid tents and water stations at an event with 2,000 people,
try 200,000 people at some of these raves.
That sounds normal.
It does sound normal.
You know, I go to bluegrass festivals with 6,000 people. There's their first aid tent. They're water stations.
Right. But what's even more problematic is that the 2003 Rave Act specifically calls attention to electronic dance music festivals. They wouldn't call attention to the bluegrass concert you're going to, or to Firefly here in the state of Delaware, which also had some hospital emergencies this past summer. And so it's as though the rave-related music, electronic dance music, is being singled out. And some people, some stakeholders say that's unfair. You know, people get stoned high and in trouble with substances at a Clear Channel concert. Why aren't they in the crosshairs of the so-called Rave Act in the same way?
We've come a long way in this country. We've, you know, when I was growing up, heroin was that dirty drug that killed jazz musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And now?
Billie Holiday.
Yep. If you think about it, this whole rhetoric of the war on drug, it makes the victims of the drug the enemy.
It does. It definitely looks for an enemy. It seeks to find an enemy. And we might be at a point in time where the so-called victims, the people dying or overdosing from heroin, prescription opiates, are not viewed as the villains. But I see evidence where we are finding new villains in the drug dealers, in the suppliers. And another interesting lesson will be if we see the same groups who are supplying the drugs as the villains. I mean, to what extent will doctors be villains? To what extent will legitimate prescribers of medications be perceived as villains? To what extent will poor people who, or Mexican cartels, or, you know, familiar villains from the past, dealers, pushers from the past? That proof is in the pudding with who will be constructed as villains when it comes to the trafficking of these drugs and the selling and the distribution of these drugs. I hope we don't repeat some of the same patterns, not only in targeting certain groups, constructing certain groups as villains when others aren't, but in even in responding to them, should there be another type of approach in handling people who get involved in selling these types of substances, or is it going to be incarceration like it has been in the past?
We're talking with Professor Tammy Anderson from the University of Delaware's Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice, and I'm joined here by our trusty intern, Abby Serfo. We haven't yet talked about tie-ins to the local area. We're talking to you in October of 2015, and earlier this month, the News Journal had a story about the hepatitis C epidemic and how that ties in with needle use, and then it gets immediately into public policy because of the expense of the medications.
Oh, absolutely. But I would suspect that is the uptick in hepatitis is related to the heroin epidemic. And again, one could start using heroin by snorting it, but eventually people transition to injecting it, and they share needles, they reuse needles. Being in the throes of their addictions, they don't necessarily employ clean needle behavior. The state of Delaware has always been conservative when it comes to passing out free needles. There are some states that have had, during the HIV epidemic in the early days, clean needle distribution programs as a way to circumvent the spread of HIV. They tried to model Amsterdam, where Amsterdam was able to cut its HIV transmission rate in half by implementing a clean needle distribution program. Delaware had a bit more trouble with implementing that. So my sense is I don't know where the state is on funding clean needle programs, but that is something which could help and would have to be revisited, of course. These are the limitations of state budgets. You know, during that time from the peak of the HIV epidemic to today, many years past, other things became a priority. Programs got cut. They weren't seen as necessary. So I do know state officials are very active in helping to bring medications to fight overdose problem. Naloxone and Narcan are the drug overdose reversing drugs that are saving lives across the state and across the country. So they're right there in thinking about medical interventions. So I'm going to hope and trust that soon, you know, clean needles will be distributed or some other type of educational programs and other interventions to stop the spread of hepatitis. But it's a real concern.
Those clean needle programs, that's right smack dab in the middle of the drug as crime, drug use as a medical issue.
So, yes, that's something people debate. When you give someone who's a drug user a clean needle, are you saying, here's the nice clean needle, go ahead and use your drugs? Are you condoning the drug use? Or are you accepting that this person's probably going to use drugs anyway, and what your job is to contain the damage from collateral consequences? You know what I'm saying? People, I think, might eventually make that same argument with naloxone and Narcan. If you revive somebody from a heroin overdose, a prescription drug from an opiate overdose, are you essentially, you know, letting them know that if they, you know, reach this point again, you know, their lives can be saved? And I think that at this point in time, there's so many people that are dying, you know, it's probably better to err on the side of saving people's lives than to worry about that. I also think that administering the Narcan and giving people clean needles is an opportunity to educate. It's an opportunity for an intervention. And so we should take that opportunity to intervene right at that point of a so-called harm reduction intervention, of a medical intervention. If we don't take that opportunity, we're missing a great possibility for an intervention and people changing courses of action.
This is just a fascinating range of topics, and I think they're also very important. I mean, looking at the drug problems in America. Thank you, Tammy.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed our talk today.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1 Newark, or online at wvud.org.